Ms. Epstein, good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Ellen Chubin Epstein, and I represent the United States in this matter. I am reserving, if I could, 3 minutes for rebuttal. The district court erred in concluding that 18 U.S.C. Section 1028A requires the government to prove that the appellee knew that the means of identification in his possession belonged to a real person. The majority of courts that have addressed this issue have concluded that the plain language of the statute does not require that, that it simply requires the government to prove that the defendant knew that the false means of identification was fraudulent, not necessarily that it belonged to a real person. These holdings are supported by well-established canons of statutory construction, as well as by the legislative history and purpose of the Act.
Can I ask you a question? Is this card valuable if the numbers were randomly selected, if they didn't belong to a person?
Absolutely.
All right, how?
The card is valuable as proof that, or alleged proof, that the defendant or the appellee has the authorization to work here or to stay here. It was supposed to be a green card that he possessed. And the green card, regardless of whether it has a real person's alien registration number or a made-up alien registration number, would offer, at least at first blush, some proof that he has the right to be here.
That's what I'm asking. I mean, right. I haven't looked into if you use this card to get a job, what the responsibility is of the employer. I know now there are heightened responsibilities, but if it turns out to be a random number and it is checked, then he can't get a job.
Oh, that is correct, and Your Honor makes an important point, which is that a real person's means of identification certainly provides better cover than a completely made-up number. And that is just one of the reasons why Congress wanted to punish more severely the use of a real means of identification, regardless of whether the appellee is aware of that being a real means of identification.
One thing I want to point out is that this system, is it not, is like the Social Security system in that these nine-digit numbers, they came up with nine digits because they thought these combinations would last forever. I mean, the combinations of the Social Security numbers. They belong to the government. That is, this nine-digit system, whether it's Social Security, whether it's immigration. And they belong to the government. They belong to somebody, either the government until it is assigned to the person or the person to whom it's assigned. So that I'm having a hard time figuring out how there could be random numbers, because these either Social Security numbers or immigration numbers are in a system that is owned by the government for assignment for legal assignment to people.
I guess I'm not sure, the exact process of assignment of numbers. I've always thought of the unassigned numbers as not belonging to anyone. They certainly don't belong to any individual who would then become the victim in this particular situation.
Why don't they belong to the government? The sequence of numbers belong to the government to be assigned by the government in a lawful way.
I guess the question assumes that there has been a set of numbers generated even before they're assigned, and I don't know that that's the case.
Okay.
You know, I understand how you could interpret the statute the way you do, but is it your position that it's implausible to interpret it the way the courts have interpreted it who have reached the opposite result, or the district court here? You think it's implausible that this statute cannot plausibly be read to extend the knowledge requirement to the of another person phrase?
I think it's implausible given several factors, given the last antecedent rule.
Given what rule?
I'm sorry, the what?
Given the last antecedent rule that the a modifier like knowingly is not supposed to extend
that.
The way down the chain, and given
let's take that for a moment,
sure,
before we go beyond the last modifier rule. The language here a means of identification of another person is, unless my third grade teacher got it completely wrong, the equivalent of another person's means of identification. Is that not true?
I believe...
It's the exact equivalent.
I believe that would have
okay.
the same meaning, yes.
So is, and let's stick with that hypothetical. Suppose that had been the language used. The you aren't denying that knowingly would apply to other persons in that context, are you? Because you can see that it applies to means of identification.
We do concede that it applies to means of identification, everything through the end of means of identification.
So if we moved up another person in a standard grammatical alternative, it would cover it, would it not?
Certainly there'd be a stronger argument
okay.
that it's covered.
Does it trouble you that the House, in summarizing what the bill did, phrased it exactly that way, knowingly possessing another person's means of identification?
Phrased it that way in the proposed statutory
House
language?
Report. That's what it said the bill did.
Mm-hmm. Right, but the statutory language that was chosen
I understand, but right. but you're saying that Congress, I guess intentionally, mm-hmm. used one formulation in the legislative history to characterize what it was doing, a formulation which would produce, well, even on your theory, a stronger case for attaching the knowingly to it, and then deliberately used a different formulation that you say makes it virtually impossible to attach knowingly to another person.
I guess I'd have two responses. I mean, one, I don't know that as much thought and care went into the wording of the House report, and I'm not sure where knowingly falls within that formulation of the House report.
Knowingly possessing another person's means of identification.
Okay. So my argument would be that more thought and care went into the wording of the actual statutory language, and that it was a deliberate choice when choosing the actual statutory language to word it as they did, so that knowingly would not modify another person's means of identification.
It is basically the same concept, though. We agree on that, right? There is no distinction in meaning between the means of identification of another person and another person's means of identification.
I think I would have to concede that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, what about 1028A2? The terrorism offense one, where the terrorism offense is the predicate. Now, that involves knowingly transferring, possessing, using, and so forth without lawful authority, a means of identification of another person, our own phrase. And then the next thing is a false identification document, right? Mm-hmm. You have it in your brief, though.
I don't know if I have the terrorism section of my brief.
Yes, you do.
Oh, I do?
You
okay.
have an attachment to your brief.
Oh, I see, in the addendum, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So now you would agree that for the second phrase there, false identification document, the falsity of the identification document is covered by knowingly.
Absolutely, and that's true for the first section as well. I mean, we are conceding that
the first section doesn't have this alternative basis of liability.
I guess what I'm saying is the first section has without lawful authority. I mean, we're conceding
they have
to know it's a fraudulent
lawful,
identity
both
document.
Both of them would have without right. lawful authority. But there are two different mm-hmm. sort of classes of pieces of paper in the second one, in B. Mm-hmm. And the second one of those two is false identification document, which is then carefully defined elsewhere in the statute. And you would agree there that knowingly would attach to falsity, would you not?
Honestly, I have not
thought
through
that particular statute. I think on your attachment
to
the last antecedent, you probably have to.
I think it would be consistent with our argument with
okay.
respect to the section
so,
here, yes.
Do you think, why would Congress, say this is a penalty with a 5-year mandatory minimum, why would Congress in the where the predicate offense is terrorism, have one type of phony document for which there's a a strong scienter requirement, and another phony document for which there's no scienter requirement at all. Or let's say a very low-level scienter requirement.
Your Honor, I honestly can't answer that. I'm not prepared to answer that, and that's not because that's not the statute at issue in this case, a particular section at issue in this case.
I know, but the phrase means of identification of another person is used four lines down in the statute books, so it would be natural to think that Congress had the same basic thing in mind, right?
I mean, we certainly would argue that that it should be interpreted consistently so that knowingly does not modify of another person. We would certainly argue that. And, you know, again, I haven't analyzed that particular section of the statute.
Of course, in subsection B, false identification document is even farther down. Knowingly has to travel a long, long distance to get to it.
Well, that's different because that would be the object of the verb.
Yeah.
So that's not a modifier of an object. That is, of another person is a prepositional phrase, as Montejo explains, modifying the
and
object.
Indistinguishable from another person's use of the possessive.
Well, again,
we've
it wasn't.
Agreed on
that's
that.
Not the language they've right. chosen, though, for
I
this
understand.
Particular statute.
I
would argue that that's deliberate.
Returning to my question to you about ambiguity versus clarity here, how do you distinguish the mode of analysis that this court used in United States versus Chin from this case?
Actually, there's no need to distinguish it. I think this court's analysis in Chin applies quite well to this
particular
statute.
Well, in that
statute.
Case, we found language quite similar to this to be ambiguous, and we went ahead and looked at legislative history.
Well, I guess to the extent that it relied on the legislative history and not the clarity of the language, it would be distinguished.
Tell me
so
why.
Perhaps this is more similar to the Fourth Circuit case.
Well, don't change my question. My question is Chin. And in Chin, the statute prohibited knowingly or intentionally employ, hire, or coerce a person under 18 years of age. And the question was whether or not the knowingly applied to whether the person was under 18. And, I mean, the structure of that sentence is virtually identical to the structure of this sentence, and this court said that that was ambiguous. And we went to legislative history. Now, we came out the way you want to, but the point is we went and looked at legislative history and structure. I mean, we referred to this section, this statute, as, quote, not a model of clarity. Now, if that's not a model of clarity, how can this statute be a model of clarity?
Well, I guess we would argue that that statute was clear, just like we're arguing that this statute is
clear. No, but the
clear.
Court said it wasn't clear.
Well, again,
we think
that could have been that decision, we would argue, could have been based on the language of the statute. But if this court chooses to look at the legislative history
The holding of the case is that the language was ambiguous. That's what the court concluded. Now, I'm sure the government argued that it wasn't, that it was clear. But the court found it ambiguous. And the only reason I'm asking you this is that here we have a case that looks to me to deal with a statute that's quite similar in language. And we found it ambiguous. And my question to you is, how, given that, can we find this language to be clear?
Well, I would argue that that case could have been decided based on the language and that this court should reconsider that analysis and do what the Cook Court did in the Fourth Circuit, which was analyzing a very similar drug statute and which found that the language was unambiguous and then also looked at the legislative history. But if this court chooses to, you know, find that the plain language doesn't resolve the question, certainly the legislative history should resolve the question in our favor. Mm-hmm.
So the government interprets this statute basically as making it illegal to knowingly possess a fake ID document, right?
Correct.
Isn't that what he pled to in count two?
That's right.
They're identical?
The mens rea for the predicate offense provides the mens rea for 1028A. Uh-huh. That is correct.
So these are identical statutes?
They're identical mens rea. Then in 1028A, you have the additional element that the government must prove that, in fact, this means of identification belonged to a real person. And that's what distinguishes the statutes.
I see.
Let's just think about our under 18 drug dealer for a moment. In that case, doesn't what the defendant sees put him on pretty strong notice that he's at high risk of dealing with someone under 18? Of course, it varies. It varies. Some of the young look very old.
It certainly may.
It's not like a random thing. We don't have any numbers, I take it, on the proportion of phony IDs that actually belong to real people versus just out there.
I certainly don't have any numbers on that.
Right.
But certainly the same.
I guess just as a moviegoer, I have a sense that the huge number of sort of generically phony IDs and a more select number of IDs that have been stolen from another person.
Again, I really have no idea which way the statistics go, but I would argue that you seem to be getting at the assumption of risk element of this. And that's exactly, we would say, the situation here, that someone like the appellee assumes the risk.
That makes your argument colorable, yeah.
So I see that my time is close to expiring. I did want to reserve rebuttal time.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning.
Mr. Kirsch.
May it please the court, Stephen Kirsch on behalf of Appley. What I first want to emphasize is exactly what Judge Friedman emphasized, and that is what he did was he looked, number one, at the name of the statute, aggravated identity theft, and said, well, there's a reason why, for that terminology. There's a reason why the word theft is in there. And that
but before you get to that, under the government's theory, the language of the statute's unambiguous. And if that's true, then you don't look at the title of the statute, right?
I understand that.
Before you can get to the title, you have to have an ambiguous statute here.
Well, that's correct.
Okay.
My view to start out with is that, and I believe it was Judge Friedman's view, is that this, in fact, the statute is not ambiguous. The plain language of the statute is clear, and the plain language of the statute requires that the person charged with this offense knew that he or she was obtaining the identity of another real person.
You don't think it's plausible to interpret it the other way?
And I was going to go back to that, Your Honor, and say that, in fact, I do concede that it is plausible to interpret it the other way because the proof is that we have a number of trial judges and the Fourth Circuit that, in fact, did interpret it the other way. So I have to concede.
I think we've held and other courts have held that the fact that different courts interpret a statute differently is not evidence of ambiguity.
It's certainly a suggestion that the rule of lenity certainly should apply in this case.
And that doesn't work out very well. That means if you had 20 district courts applying the statute the way the government does, and one coming up the other way, then everyone's got to switch and say, oh, ambiguous rule of lenity. Why do all go the government's way?
But we don't have that breakdown where we have 20-1, and I would.
Take our word for it. It doesn't work in this circuit.
You
can't get anywhere with that.
Very well.
Okay.
But I would go back.
So let's go back to my question. Do you, setting that aside, the fact that courts have reached different conclusions, you concede, I take it then, that it is plausible to interpret the statute the way the government has.
I don't agree, and I don't believe Judge Friedman agreed.
We're reviewing Judge Friedman's decision here.
Is it a plausible interpretation? I would say I have to concede that because we have a number of very well-reasoned opinions that do interpret it the way the government suggests.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is plausible.
Okay. So you're not arguing that this is plain anymore, right?
My initial argument is that it is plain because that's still my view. Mm-hmm. But conceding that it is plausible that a well-reasoned person looking at this can interpret it another way, I certainly have to concede that point.
Okay. Thank you.
But I would ask the court
Can I ask you to look at the language? Do you have it in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. if that language read, whoever, blah, 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 knowingly transfers, possesses, without lawful authority, a means of identification, not his own, what would your position be?
Well, my position would be, means of identification, not his own. Well, I don't know that that changes the statute that much. I think that my position will remain similar. You still have the knowledge requirement.
Well, in that case, it seems to me that the defendant knows.
Let him answer.
You still, knowledge, guilty knowledge, mens rea, has to be established, whether we have the language that's in the statute as written or in, this, in the terminology that the court suggested. So I don't know that it would make much of a difference.
Okay.
I would, the case that the government cited in its Rule 28J letter that was just decided last week from Iowa, Salazar versus United States, we had a flurry of cases from Iowa. We had three cases that came down by the same judge who ruled the way the government is asking this court to rule, and then we had another judge, district court decision from Iowa, which ruled in the way that I'm asking the court to rule. And Salazar is a lengthy opinion. It's very well reasoned. It goes into analysis, goes into legislative history. But interestingly, what I found most interesting about Salazar is that it doesn't mention Judge Friedman's opinion. Now, his opinion was oral, but it doesn't make mention at all because it does a survey of different cases. But the way that the court reached the conclusion that, in fact, knowingly did extend all the way down the line is the same reasoning that Judge Friedman applied. And again, the court said you have to look at the name of the statute, you have to look at the grammatical structure of the statute. And what Judge Friedman said in terms of looking at the grammatical structure, he said, well, let's look at excitement video from the Supreme Court, and we had a very similar statute, and the Supreme Court said that the term knowingly goes all the way down the line. And the government comes back and said, well, but excitement really only applied to situations where you're protecting otherwise innocent conduct. And Judge Friedman, as well as Judge Salazar, did not accept that. And they said grammatical structure is grammatical structure, no matter what you're using it for. And so for that reason, also citing Liparota and also citing from the Supreme Court Arthur Anderson, all of those cases, in each of those cases, you had a statute knowingly, you had verbs, and then you had an object. And in three out of three cases from the Supreme Court, they said knowingly applies not just to the verb, but it goes all the way down the line to the object. And
well,
that's
how about Freed and Fiola, then? The two that said you don't have to know the hand grenade case and the assault of a federal officer where the crime itself, I mean, where there was no innocent conduct, the possession of a hand grenade or assaulting anyone, whether federal officer or not.
Right. I understand those cases, and I know that they exist, but we're asking the court to follow the line, the most recent line, and that the most recent of the cases is Arthur Anderson, which I believe was a 2005 case.
And the innocent conduct here would be, it could be a random number?
It could be, exactly, and that's the problem, that's a major problem with the government's interpretation. The government says, well, if you have one of these cards, you don't know anything about the car. You don't know anything about who this car may actually belong to. If it happens to be numbers belonging to an actual person, you're guilty. If they're numbers that don't happen to belong to an actual person, you're not guilty.
But isn't the person whose number that turns out to have been, isn't that person a victim of identity theft? Even if the defendant didn't know that? And that's the point the district court in Maine made.
Yes. Hypothetically, if the number turned out to actually belong.
Well, not hypothetically. It is a person's number.
If it did
that
belong.
That person is a victim of identity theft, right?
No question.
And wasn't this statute designed to protect people from identity theft?
But it I agree, Your Honor, that it was designed to protect people. But before we go to the design, it also was the way it's written. It's designed to prosecute people, only those people who know that the number belongs to an actual person.
If you have two threads in the legislative history, I mean, there's language which does say this is aimed at getting at people who steal identities, right?
Yes.
But there's also language in the reports suggesting that it's to protect people from identity theft. So you have both.
That's correct.
What do we do with that?
Well, what we do is we say that in a situation, if a person possesses a means of identification that doesn't have real numbers, then nothing is stolen because there's no victim. So, and that's what's troubling about the government's interpretation of this statute, is that they are seeking to prosecute people and incarcerate them for 2 years, where you have potential for a situation where there is no victim, there is no one whose card
was actually
stolen.
I don't really understand that. On the loss side of the balance, we do have someone. Your argument has got to be that the focus in looking at legislative history and the statute should be on the way the language defines the perpetrator. From the victim's point of view, it looks very much the same, doesn't it?
Well, it does, assuming that there's a victim. We don't know. In these instances, what occurs is people come across the border. They get up to Los Angeles. They encounter someone. They pay them some money. And the person comes back with a card and with numbers. That's exactly what happened in this situation. We have a statute that prosecutes that, and that's 1546, and that's what Mr. Villanueva Sotelo pled guilty to. To jump it up and say, well, you're going to get 2 more years of incarceration, Congress said you had to know that that card belonged to an actual person.
No, that card had to belong to another person.
It didn't have to. It's not automatic. We don't know where these cards come from.
No, to get the two-year enhancement, it has to belong to someone else.
And the person who is found guilty of that had to have known.
Well, that's your position.
But that knowledge is so critical because it's the only element that distinguishes it, 1028A, from the 1546 offense. It's a separate element. 1546 covers being in possession of a forged document. And that's what Mr. Villanueva Sotelo.
No, what it distinguishes it also is that the first statute you can violate without it being assigned to someone else.
That's right.
All right, so the enhancement is if it has in fact been assigned to someone else.
No, the enhancement is if you knew it belonged to a real person.
That's what we're trying to determine.
Okay, well, that I'm sorry.
And I wanted to ask you one thing about your brief because you said a minute ago something was hypothetical. On page 2, you describe this case as a case such as this where it could not be shown that the identity and issue belonged to an actual person. And that's conceded here, isn't it? That this is an already assigned number.
Well, it was agreed that Mr. Villanueva Sotelo did not know that it belonged to a particular person, and there was a proffer that the government made that it was assigned to a particular person.
Did you have any problem with that?
I had no way to dispute it. They had a case agent from ICE who came in and said, I couldn't dispute it.
The other thing I wanted to ask you was, is it your position then that practically the only people who could be convicted or who could get the enhanced punishment and could be convicted would be the manufacturer of these cards, the maker, rather than the possessor?
They would be the most likely category of people to be convicted, but certainly the person who comes into possession of it could have the knowledge that it actually belonged to someone. I could think of any number of scenarios where the person in possession who isn't the manufacturer of it knows that it came from somebody else. It could be a friend, could be a relative, any number of instances or could know that it was stolen. But that knowledge requirement is absolutely, we would submit, essential because again, you look at the legislative history, and I think we cited 15 to 20 cases that were cited in the legislative history. Every single one of those instances suggests that the perpetrator knew that the identity he or she was stealing belonged to an actual person. There's not any mention in the legislative history of a situation such as this. But for all of those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the opinion of Judge Friedman. Thank you.
You want to take a minute?
I believe that Judge Tatel, in his question to appellee's counsel, just really hit the nail on the head, that the emphasis in the legislative history is on the victims of identity theft.
And isn't there just as much, there's just as much emphasis, as I read it, on getting at people who steal, identities. There's both in the legislative history, isn't there?
Well, it is both. However, mm-hmm. permeating the legislative history is the idea that the victims are victimized regardless of whether a particular defendant knows or doesn't mm-hmm. know that he's using a real person's means of identification.
Let's pause there for a mm-hmm. moment. Suppose the person is using the phony ID only for situations where it sort of gets him onto a job or something like that, right?
Or suppose he's just possessing it.
Extreme case, he just possesses it. But in other words,
it
would seem to me that in the case of an ID which happens to belong to a real person, there would be many perpetrators who would never embark on the project of using it in a way which is detrimental to the actual person, right? I mean, the people who use fake IDs to get into bars aren't inflicting any injury on the real person.
Well, if they're then arrested, then they obviously would be inflicting injury on that real person's criminal record. The point is the potential is always there. This is not a theft of a tangible object. This is the theft of something intangible and something very fundamental. And the potential is always there that a real person will be harmed when his means of identification is in someone else's possession and it's possibly going to be used. And that's the concern that the legislative history expresses. And it's implausible mm-hmm. that Congress, after expressing that concern, would then erect a barrier to prosecution uh-huh. by requiring the government to prove that the appellee knew that this means of identification belonged to a real person.
See, once you've crossed the line from clarity to ambiguity, which you have now, because you're now relying on the legislative history, You have to deal with all the legislative history and with the title, Aggravated Identity Theft, right?
That is the title.
How can it be Aggravated Identity Theft when the number's not associated with the, how can it be Aggravated Identity Theft when the person who is being charged has no idea whether the identity belongs to anybody?
Well, again, as the Godin Court said in its second opinion, it's theft from the victim's perspective.
I'm just talking about the title. Aggravated Identity Theft.
Right, well, there are certainly canons of construction that the title by itself should not limit the
language
of the statute.
But once you're into ambiguity, you were the one who, you just stood up here and started talking about legislative history.
As an alternative argument, Your Honor.
Okay, but once you're there, I understand that. Your position is this statute's clear. I understand that. I mean, I understand that's your position.
Yes.
But once you start using legislative history, you've opened up not only all the legislative history, but also the name of the statute.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, if...
You've opened up the role of the rule of lenity.
Well, I have a couple of responses. I don't believe we've gotten to the point of the rule of lenity because I don't believe there's a grievous ambiguity like the case law requires for the application of the rule of lenity. But getting to your first point, I think there's plenty of case law saying that the title of the statute by itself should not limit the text of the statute. And the term theft, I don't believe, is used in the text and is not...
You mean you can only use the title to expand...
Well, the point is that...
I don't understand that interpretive rule. How does that work?
If it's inconsistent, if the title is inconsistent with the thrust of the statute, it's inconsistent with the thrust...
An unambiguous text.
Yeah, right.
Well, again, this is our alternative argument. If the court... Right. We would like the court to decide that this is an unambiguous statute and decide it our way. If the court gets to the point where it can't conclude that and wants to look instead at the legislative history, we would say that the legislative history certainly makes it clear that...
But I think now you're accepting Judge Tatel's point. Once we're into the area of ambiguous text, looking at the title is fine, right?
Well...
You have to accept that.
I'm not saying that the title doesn't come into it, but the question is, if you have a title that can be interpreted, but if you have a title that can be interpreted in different ways, and, you know, either interpreted
traditionally. Sure, the ambiguities in the title are before us, but.
Well, you know, that can be, yes.
But you see, the phrase aggravated identity theft is perfectly consistent with the defendant's interpretation of the statute. It's not consistent with your interpretation of the statute, but it's true. You can't use a title to produce an implausible interpretation of the statute.
Well,
but it's totally consistent with the district court's view of it.
With all due respect, I believe the title's not inconsistent with our position. It may not be inconsistent with the defendant's
it's
position as well, but it's certainly not inconsistent with our position that there is a theft that occurred from the victim's perspective, regardless of whether.
I don't know why you're running away from the legislative history in the House report, which says, using the phrase identity theft, mm-hmm. says the terms identity theft and identity fraud, which to me sounds like they're using them synonymously, refer to all types of crimes in which someone wrongfully obtains and uses another person's personal data in some way that involves fraud or deception. I don't see anything about knowingly or knowing that it's somebody else. So.
That's correct. I believe we cited, if not that particular section, another section like that in our reply brief.
Right.
That's
correct. I wanted to ask you, what was your response to Mr. Kirsch's answer to my question that if you change the language to not his own, it wouldn't make much difference? Sounds to me like.
I think it would make a huge difference, Your
yeah,
Honor.
But if it doesn't make a difference, then he doesn't have to know that it belongs to someone else. He just has to know it's not his own.
I mean, just knowing it's not his own is the predicate offense.
Mm-hmm.
The additional element of 1028A is that we can prove that it belongs to somebody else.
Right.
That's the difference between the two statutes.
All right, Mr. Kirsch, you were appointed to represent the defendant. We thank you for your very able assistance.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Stand, please.